Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I'm Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland. I'm your hostess for this evening. And as always, we're brought to you through the good offices of the great people at www.patriotfamilies.com. And all of us at Patriot Families truly believe that we are the nation. It's why we do what we do and say what we say, and we welcome the opinions and ideas and concerns of our fellow Americans. It is that, ladies and gentlemen, that makes us unique and that makes us great, that every one of us has a voice and the freedom to use it. Well, we're back again for another episode of Patriot Education. It is the 5th of September. And just about everybody in the nation is sending their kids back to school. I managed to survive the first 3 days running up and down the stairs, which was quite a workout because I live in a one-story house and I've been incredibly lazy all summer and haven't climbed any stairs. So by the end of today, every staircase appeared to be the Himalaya Mountains, and I began to feel as if I needed to hire some Sherpa guides to carry me up and down them. Our topic tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is school safety. How far should we go? As I said a minute ago, everybody's sending their kids back to school this week across the country. Many have already gone back, depending on which state you live in and whether or not you have a standard start date for the whole state or its county option or all of the varied ways we deal with educating our children time-wise throughout the nation. But when we send our kids back to school, many of us, teachers and staff at our schools and parents, are remembering the tragedy at Newtown, Connecticut last December. And we are thinking about those innocent lives that were lost, both the children and the teachers who tried to protect them. We face a conundrum. How do we make our kids safe in school without creating an atmosphere that more closely resembles a maximum security prison than it does a happy and joyful learning environment. Many different suggestions have been made. Many different actions have been taken since Newtown. DeKalb County in Georgia wants to stockpile assault rifles in a locked gun safe so that the school resource officers there can get at them in case of an invasion by an insane killer. I believe in Utah, several different areas have started arming teachers, and there are other counties and municipalities across the country who are offering gun safety courses and arming the teachers and staff in their schools. It's a horrible thought to think that our kids can't happily go off to school with their brand new whatever superhero lunchbox and their new sneakers and their first day jeans and T-shirts and whatever else they think is fashionable without parents wondering whether or not they will come home. Even though Newtown is no longer in the news, it is in the back of the minds of the teachers and the staff at every school in the nation and every parent who sends his child off to school. As I said, we've got lots of different opinions about what should be done. Many people are in favor of arming school staff. My friend Mr. Beasley in the chat room says he doesn't think it's a good idea, and I can understand that because it has so many cons as well as pros. The objection he raises is that kids and other innocents might potentially get caught in the crossfire of a gunfight, and that is a very real possibility. There's also the real possibility that if there is no way to fight back against someone with a gun, those same children will be mowed down even if they try to get away, or hunted down if they hide, or shot lying down or cowering under a desk. As I said, there are many, many, many different opinions. I can't say that I would advocate that everybody wear a sidearm every time they walk into the school building if they are a teacher, a custodian, a cafeteria worker, a principal, an assistant principal, a guidance counselor. It smacks too much of the vigilantes of the Old West. But I do believe that having access to firearms, if you are in a classroom and a teacher, is not a bad thing. We do drills every year, several of them, at my school, for all different sorts of potential disasters, including an armed intruder in the school. The protocol for such a drill is to lock the classroom door, get everybody away from a window, and down on the floor, and wait until the all clear is given. That is only partially reassuring. If someone with an assault rifle is determined to get inside my classroom, I'm pretty sure they would just shoot the door lock out, walk in, and start spraying bullets. But if I were equipped with a weapon, I would at least have a single chance to eliminate that person before he could break into another classroom and do the same thing to another group of students or teachers. The problem that arises whenever you oppose violence with violence is, how do you determine how anyone will act in a crisis situation? Would I freeze and stand there and be shot? Would I reach for a weapon and shoot back? I don't know, ladies and gentlemen. I cannot tell, under those kind of conditions, what I would do. But I believe that having the option to fight back and to stop an intruder before he kills others is a viable way to go. Newtown's elementary school did everything right, according to our understanding at the time. They had security. They had locked doors. All of the entrances to the school were locked. They had cameras to see who was at the door, and the door locks could only be released from the main office. And all of those security measures didn't work, because the young man who wanted to feel something shot his way in through the windows besides the doors. We could redesign our schools so that there were no openings to the outside except doors, and those were kept locked. But again, that creates an atmosphere that makes our kids feel even more imprisoned than kids normally do in school. And believe me, they feel imprisoned all the time, purely and simply because they're having to do things that they don't necessarily want to do, and they can't just get up and leave or go play or, you know, run to the bathroom whenever they feel like it. The kind of minor imprisonment that they face being in a classroom is what we're used to. Do we want our kids to live in fear? Do we want them to walk into school escorted by armed guards and in a building where you don't see the light of day for fear that someone will shoot you through a window? It is an unsolvable dilemma, ladies and gentlemen, mainly because in spite of all of the let's concentrate on mental health preventive measures, it is not possible to get inside the heart and mind of another human being and predict accurately what he or she will do. All we can do is try to minimize the risk for our kids. One way is to make sure that schools have locked entrances and key card admission for school personnel. The school where I work does not have those facilities as yet. We've been told that we are in line to get them, but we are creating new classrooms that aren't finished yet, and some of our kids have to be able to go out through two side doors to get to classrooms that are being held in trailer-like facilities. So until all of the classrooms are indoors inside the building, there will have to be open doors for the children to pass through. And key cards for the children really isn't practical in middle school, given the fact that when you have approximately 200 children changing classes at the same time, the idea of everybody having to pass a key card through something in order to get to class, nobody's going to get there on time. It's logistically impossible, unless you just put them on a conveyor belt and run them from class to class in a tram sort of affair. But I don't know of any place in this nation that is wealthy enough to redesign and rebuild every school from elementary through middle through high school so the children are never exposed to anything and ride around the school in individual popemobiles. And to go back to the prevent it before it happens and the, oh, we've got to put more money in mental health screening. There is always a progressive out there who swears up and down that if we just fund something fully, we can prevent any kind of risk from ever arising. It is the fundamental disconnect between progressive, quote-unquote, thinking and common sense. Life is a risk, ladies and gentlemen. We do the best we can. We try to make the risk as minimal as we can. But there is no way that we can eliminate totally risk or danger from anybody who is actually alive. In this country, we believe that we were founded on the principle of individual liberty. We're taught this, or we used to be at any rate when I went to school. Even today's children do get it mentioned every now and again. But the corollary to individual liberty is twofold. It includes individual responsibility, and it includes the fact that liberty is a risk. When you have choice, when you have options, there is no guarantee that the choice will always be correct, or the option you choose will always be the right one. We are free in many ways. We choose where we want to live, what type of work we wish to do, our friends, our mates, our associates, our pleasures, our entertainment. We care for our children. We treat our children as being more precious than gold, which is justifiable. They are. They are the future. Without them, without new lives coming in, nothing will progress in the real sense of the world, and the entire human race will die. But this care for our children is sometimes carried to absurdity. My friend, Mr. Beasley, mentions that in many school districts, teachers and aides and staff are being laid off because the budgetary funds are not there to pay them. And if they can't pay the teachers, where is the money going to come from for armed security guards and refurbishing the schools with new lock systems and key cards and RIF chips in the kids and all of the other things that people have put forth as a possible solution? I am not saying that we should take a laissez-faire attitude and say, oh, well, you know, somebody's going to do it anyway. We'll just send the kids to school and not worry about it because it probably won't happen to us. Although, in a way, that's partly what I believe. Yes, we do need to take precautions. We need to make sure that the people who come in and out of our schools while the children are there are people who have a reason to be there other than to commit a violent act. But there is no guarantee that someone who has a reason to be there, a parent, for example, who is coming to drop off a forgotten lunchbox, or a grandmother who is coming by to pick up a child to take them to a doctor's appointment, or an aunt or an uncle or a big sister or a big brother who's coming in to bring a forgotten object or medications to the clinic. There is no guarantee that even someone who has a perfectly legitimate reason, at least apparently, to come into school is not going to be a hidden and suddenly bursting into full flower homicidal maniac who decides, instead of dropping off the medicine at the clinic, to start shooting everybody in the office. There is no way to be absolutely sure. Our ancestors knew this. Long ago, when there was no such thing as public education, and there was no such thing as the thrice be sent to the nether regions Department of Education, each community was responsible for educating its children. I even went to a one-room schoolhouse, ladies and gentlemen, when I was in first grade. And I certainly didn't feel terror when I walked into the building. School was a place where you went to learn things and see your friends, and, you know, you had a good time there. I didn't feel that at any time during my public education or in the private school I attended when I was a child either. But part of the reason why we are afraid now, ladies and gentlemen, isn't that behavior like this is new and unexpected. There have been school shooting incidents since our country began. Some of them perpetrated by bands of disenchanted Native Americans whose land was taken away from them. Some of them by homicidal maniacs. The people who did those acts were punished. in some fashion, usually by death, sometimes by imprisonment. Sometimes they punish themselves by taking their own lives. There is no way to prevent insanity, ladies and gentlemen, and that's what it takes to do the kind of thing we saw in Newtown, Connecticut last year. And the individual who did it had been through the mills of the system and the psychological and psychiatric counseling and everything else. And there was no way that it could have been predicted that he would do what he did. Preventive measures are impossible. It's the same sideways, backwards, upside down thinking that says that we can prevent crime by hiring more policemen. The assumption that that is the job of a police officer is to prevent crime. It's not. The job of a police officer is to apprehend the perpetrator of crime, incarcerate that person until he or she can be brought to trial, or until bail is set pending a trial. Policemen are not there to prevent crime. They are not authorized to walk up and shoot you because they think you are going to start shooting somebody else. If that were the kind of world we lived in, nobody would ever leave their house. Because there's no guarantee that being a policeman automatically means that you are sane, sober, and have the judgment ability of God. But because school safety is a real issue, it has become a favorite bone for progressives to gnaw and drag around and wave in front of Congress and the public. Let us remake humanity, and you won't have to be afraid to send your children to school. Anytime there is a horrible crime, anytime there are innocent lives lost, progressives jump up and down and scream that if we only gave them more money and more power, they could have prevented this. And there are many people out there who believe it. There's a metaphysical discussion going on in our Patriot Education chat room about whether or not there are absolutes, such as absolute evil or absolute good. That has been one of the great questions since Plato and Aristotle, and probably back in ancient Egypt under the pharaohs, and not just Akhenaten, the heretic pharaoh, but all the Ramses and the second Henrys and the rest of them. Every single human being would like to think that there are absolutes of good and evil, and that he or she knows exactly what they are. But unfortunately, because we are not God, we cannot totally understand the concept of an absolute anything, because all of our experience of the world, of one another, and of our life is and must be subjective. We are the ultimate mix of our life experience, the individuals who have influenced us, our education, our personalities, the peak experiences we may have enjoyed. The fact that our lives make us subjective in this respect is one of the ways that progressives pull people into the idea that there is no bad behavior, there is only communication we cannot understand. Or that there is no right and wrong, there is only different. Well, there is right and wrong. But the right and wrong of a society is not always the same thing as the right and wrong of the individuals who live in it. A person who takes joy in hurting, killing, or damaging other living beings is not acceptable within any society because he or she is a danger to that society. He or she is not inclined to live by the societal rules that allow the society to flourish. Right and wrong, law, if you will, are created or agreed upon within societies and cultures as a means of making sure that the society or culture survives. Without some sort of interpersonal and interactive behavioral standards, the society will fall apart. It will not be cohesive enough to accomplish anything because there are some aspects of life and living that require people to work together, at least amicably enough, so that some major project gets done. In a sense, that's what the school safety issue is about. It's not about right and wrong for the individual who commits the act. It's about the viability of the society in which that act is committed. If we are to continue as a nation and as a society, we need to nurture and protect our progeny because it is they who will carry on the viability of the society into which they are born. They will be the authors of change to that society if change is needed or desired. They will be the ones who will fuel that society by their efforts, by their contributions, by their actions. And because we know this, we want to protect them. We want to keep them safe from harm. But, like with school safety, how far should we go? How do we determine what it is we teach them about safety? Is it safety of their person in the sense that they will be intact, not damaged, not hurt, not either physically or emotionally? Or is it the safety of the group that we teach them? Progressive education thinks it's the safety of the group. Libertarian and conservative ideology believes it's the safety and security of the individual. And this, if you will, bipolarity that we're experiencing in our society right now has very real effects. The progressive safety of the group is behind the Common Core. And the idea that we need to screen everybody for mental disorders so we prevent them from walking in and shooting a bunch of school children. The security of the individual is part of the ideology of the libertarian or the conservative. In that, if someone is bullying you, the best way to defeat a bully is to make that bully so uncomfortable that he or she stops the behavior. The old-fashioned way used to be a nice little fist fight in which you stood up to the bully because you went and learned Taekwondo. But now, since we have a progressive liberal educational system, the way we defeat the bully is to have weekly meetings about how bullying is bad and how much we love one another and what to do if you're being bullied and who to tell and, you know, all of this stuff. So again, we come back to that bipolarity, that which is the absolute, the safety of the group or the safety of the individual. That is the underlying problem that we have in trying to determine how far we need to go to keep our children safe in school. Obviously, most parents would like to make sure, if they possibly could, that nothing would ever harm one teeny tiny hair follicle of their beloved child. Yes, you would like to be able to do that. But unfortunately, unless you keep that delightful beloved child and their hair follicles locked up in a closet for the rest of his or her natural life, somebody, sometime, or something is going to harm them. My friend Mr. Beasley says that bullying isn't new. Kids are cruel to each other, and he's quite correct. They are. It is part of being a child. I always kind of have to laugh at the progressives because, you know, they are so determined that they are so modern and so forward-thinking. And yet their vision of the sweet, angelic, innocent children is straight out of a Victorian Christmas card. Victorian ideals, where children were all perfect little angels who must be kept from, away from the corrupting society of their parents and stay with their nanny and have lunch in the schoolroom and dinner in the schoolroom and only come into the parlor when they were dressed properly and bow politely and say, how do you do to guests, and then go off to bed. Because children were precious little angels. No, they're not. Children are not precious little angels, even the very nicest of them, because they're human beings, ladies and gentlemen. They are just like the rest of us, composed of yin and yang, a little higher than the beasts and a little lower than the angels. My friend Mr. Beasley says he's sure that the kids in the Victorian age were mean, too. They certainly were. If you've ever actually read any historical accounts or even fictionalized accounts of what British schools were like in the Victorian age, and that's where we get the word fag. At that time, it had nothing to do with homosexuality. It was a standard operating procedure in public schools, which in Britain are private schools, like Eton and Harrow, that the older boys always had a little younger boy to be their fag. They're kind of semi-servant. They took the younger kid under their wing and protected him from the other big kids who might bully him. But in exchange, the little one got to do all the bad stuff or the uncomfortable stuff or all the stuff that the big one didn't want to do. Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, most progressives live in a very unreal world. They live in a world where government, meaning themselves, can and should redesign the human race by nudging, by regulation, by euthanasia, by selective breeding, by any means possible. And if they are given a free hand to do so, we will all be much happier because no single one of us will ever make a wrong choice and have to suffer the consequences because we won't have any choices. We will be part of the Borg collective and we will all be safe. School safety wasn't an issue with the Borg, ladies and gentlemen, because everybody was basically created equal in the sense that they had what they needed in combined mechanical and flesh parts to fulfill their designated role within the collective group. And it is this ideology, this thinking pattern, this mechanistic approach to life that has been permeating our public education system for the last 35 years. It's more blatant and more open now than it was 30 years ago. But it isn't new. Just like bullying isn't new. And it was done in Hitler's Germany in the 1930s. almost 100 years ago, and for the same reasons. The only real difference is that Hitler's Germany, the chosen people, were of one specific ethnicity. Under progressive thinking today, the ethnicity of the chosen people doesn't matter. The chosen people are who the chosen people choose to be chosen. Which means anybody who's willing to be their fag obviously can be part of the chosen people. Another reason, ladies and gentlemen, why I'm an advocate of teaching history, because there are very few new ideas when it comes to organizing societies. We are fortunate in that we live in a nation that was founded on a new idea. An idea that did not exist in any known society at the time our nation was founded. The idea that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. The idea that human beings could govern themselves. We have managed to do it, sometimes better than others, for about 250 years, or close to that. And hopefully, we'll continue to manage to do it, in spite of current ideologies and current political beliefs. But we will always stumble and fall and pick ourselves back up and rebuild it again. Because human beings can only govern themselves as a society or a nation if they can govern themselves as individuals. And quite often, they can't. Unfortunately, it's very easy to condemn someone who makes a statement about what is right and wrong as being unable to speak for everyone. It's very easy to do that because it's quite true. I can't speak for anyone but me. I can't speak for everyone. I can't say that all parents care about their kids because there are some who don't. I make the perhaps unwarranted assumption that they do because my experience, my life experience in my own family and working with children both as a private tutor and in the public education system is that the vast majority of them do. Now, there are some that don't, and I have met them. But I tend to think that they are the outliers on the box and whisker plot and not the norm. I have no control over how someone else raises their child. The only control I have is over myself in social situations or in what I say or what I believe. In my job, I must exert control over my classroom because that is part of the function for which I am paid. The control I exert is necessary for several reasons. Since my classroom is an in-school suspension room, that means that the students who are there must experience negative consequences of unacceptable behavior in school. What they do outside my classroom when they go home, I have no control over, and I absolutely don't want any. They are not my children. I do not control what my stepdaughters do in their home with their children. However, when they visit me, my grandchildren abide by my rules. Because in my home, I am a benevolent despot. My friend Mr. Beasley, I'm guessing, is a libertarian, as I am, in that I tend to agree with Jefferson's nice little statement that if it doesn't break my arm or pick my pocket, I don't care what you do. And I would add one additional qualifier. I would prefer that you not ask me to participate in or watch what you do if I'm not interested. Public education, ladies and gentlemen, the safety of your children in school cannot possibly include protecting them from ideas that are not the same as yours. My friend Mr. Beasley apparently doesn't like being called Mr., but since I have a fondness for courtesy, I use that title in the fashion of courteous address, not as an indication of any opinion on my part, merely the fact that I feel that it is part of my self-respect to show respect to other people. I believe that the exposure to ideas which are different from those you learned at home can and should be a positive thing. I dislike bigotry, no matter what it's based on. Oh, my apologies to Mr. Beasley. I misunderstood his comments. I do not believe, however, that exposure to ideas that are different from what you learn at home means that you should be expected to espouse those ideas or agree with them if you do not. This is difficult to achieve in school, ladies and gentlemen, because the philosophy of multiculturalism is counterproductive when you are trying to teach children more than academics, which is what our public schools are told they have to do. If our job were just to teach them the facts of history, the processes of mathematics, the understanding of the scientific method, and the way in which the various atoms join together to create molecules and molecules join together to create substances and the three states of matter, and social studies were about the history of the world and us and the differences between our culture and other people's. If English was about learning to read well enough so that you didn't need to have a dictionary beside you in eighth grade when you were reading an eighth grade level book, the understanding of how to use the language of the country correctly, coherently, and concisely in both spoken and written communication. If those were the only things that we as educators were required to do, the debate over multiculturalism would not arise. But it isn't the only thing we are required to do. Not only are we required to protect the physical safety of our children, as in the anti-bullying, so on and so on and so on and so on, we are also expected to somehow or other convince every child in school that anybody's ideas are okay and nobody's ideas are better than theirs or worse than theirs. Results of this kind of multiculturalism and combined with freedom of speech and so on and so forth, to the point that I had one student, when I disagreed with an interpretation she gave of a story that they were reading in her class, She became very upset and accused me of limiting her power of free speech because I did not agree with her interpretation of the story. And it was this disconnect that points up the problem of trying to ensure the psychological safety of children in a learning environment. School safety, instead of being the physical safety, so they're not terrified somebody's going to come in and shoot them, has broadened so much that now it includes, God forbid, anybody gets their feelings hurt. It is the burgeoning mushroom of political correctness that goes along with the progressive ideology that there is no right or wrong, everything is relative, and nobody ever has to be like anybody else, and nobody will ever argue, we'll all just love one another, sit down together and sing kumbaya. Because our public schools, ladies and gentlemen, have been assigned the job of replacing psychologists, psychiatrists, ministers, parents, grandparents, counselors, athletic coaches, nurses, babysitters, nurses' aides, because of the Department of Education's guarantee that a free, appropriate public education will be made available to everybody, no matter their disability, difficulty, ethnicity, or whatever, we have a mess. We can't have the kind of safety that progressives swear up and down that they can give us. We cannot protect our children out of everything they own. I'm plagiarizing a bit from The King and I. And The King does his song about, if I have allies that are strong to protect me, will they not protect me out of all that I own? This is what our public schools and their passion for the safety of our children has become. I cannot say that the young man who committed the horrible act in Newtown did so because of the climate of the schools he grew up in that said there was no bad behavior, only communication we do not understand. I do not know that that was the case because I cannot get inside that young man's head and couldn't have even if he were still alive. But I can't help but wonder if that climate played a part. There are many, many, many different views of what's right and wrong across this nation of ours, ladies and gentlemen. They vary from community to community and household to household. Alcibiades couldn't answer Plato's question, what is the good, any more than I can. I know what appears to be the good and the right in whatever situation I happen to be in at the moment, but I cannot be objective enough to say that that would be the same good or right for everybody else in that situation, or even the other people who are in it with me. The only thing I can say and do is to try to live by one basic principle, which is the one that we should be teaching our children. And we should be required to teach only that to our children. in addition to the academics that we are supposed to be teaching them in schools. And that's fairly simple. Do unto others as you would be done by. That principle, that idea, is fundamental to just about every religious belief system that human beings have created. If you honestly do treat others the way you wish to be treated, you're probably not going to go too far wrong. That has been a principle that has kept societies together. It's why we have the laws that we do. I am not allowed to steal your belongings because that would imply that you could steal mine. I am not allowed to sign my name to a check that belongs to someone else and exchange it for money because that would imply that you would be allowed to sign my check and take my money. Like most very simple ideas, it's too easy. It's not complex enough. It's not deep enough. It doesn't have enough data-driven evidence behind it. The basic common sense, as my friend Lonnie suggests, which is what that's based on, is extraordinarily uncommon, ladies and gentlemen. And yes, it is ironic. And being alive and being human means that you are steeped in irony. Because no matter how hard we try, or how much we talk, or how many rallies we go to, or how many various organizations we belong to, we are not going to redesign human beings into God. And unfortunately, that's what it would take to eliminate risk and have a perfectly safe and perfectly comfortable and perfectly equal world. What we can and should do is to remind our children at home and in school that if they truly do try to follow that one simple, basic, common sense idea of treat other people the way you wish to be treated, it's likely that they will become a successful human being in the ways that matter. They may never be rich. They are very likely never going to be powerful. It could happen, but it probably won't. But they will be successful. As successful as a human being can be. School safety would be less of a hot-button issue, ladies and gentlemen, if our public schools were allowed to teach the academics that they were intended for and rely on the golden rule for all of the other roles they are now being encouraged to play. I have seen behaviors and actions and consequences and lack thereof that have drifted so far away from that basic common sense that if it weren't so sad and so disruptive in a classroom, it would truly be theater of the absurd. Like Michael Smith in Stranger in a Strange Land watching the monkey cage, you just have to laugh. For those of you who haven't read that novel, I suggest you get a copy and read that segment, because it's the pivot point when Michael, raised by Martians, suddenly becomes a human being. We are relying on our schools, ladies and gentlemen, to be surrogate parents and surrogate grandparents. We are expecting them to raise our children for us. We are using every specious argument in the book to excuse and treat and care for sociopaths if they're under 18. And once they get to be 18, then society falls on them very hard. If we would stop excusing and promoting sociopathy from age 1 to age 18, we might have less violent sociopaths shooting children. I can't and won't say that we wouldn't have any, because there will be. But we might lower the risk, even slightly. But again, common sense, the golden rule, treat one another the way you wish to be treated, is too easy. You can't be paid $150,000 to stand up in front of an audience and say that and then walk off the stage. You can't get tenure by publishing that in a pamphlet. You can't get elected to Congress just stating, treat one another the way you wish to be treated. My friend, Mr. Beasley, seems to feel that being passionate about what one believes and expressing one's passion about it is a form of mental instability. It may well be. I don't know. But then again, we are not just minds. We are also hearts and bodies. And all three parts of our nature come together to make us who we are. When one speaks from the heart, one might offend someone else, because emotions aren't shareable. Opinions are individual. They're neither right nor wrong. They're merely different. Doesn't mean you have to agree with them. But discussion and argument and disagreement is meat and drink to many people. My husband was a debater in high school. My youngest stepdaughter would much rather have a disagreement than have things be pleasant. She came home from school one day, ranting and raving about how she'd really ticked off the teacher, and the teacher was in trouble because the teacher talked back to her and all this, that, and the other. And I asked her, well, why did you do that? And she looked at me as if, you know, I couldn't possibly be asking her why she did it. She was amazed. Why would I ask that? So I just, I really would like to know, I told her. Why did you do that? And she said, well, because it's fun. And to her, it was. It was fun to deliberately antagonize her teacher. She enjoyed it. Unfortunately, she didn't enjoy having people antagonize her. Again, common sense is rare. But, as our founding fathers knew, human beings are not angels. They're not God, and they never will be. They are fundamentally flawed, and they will make mistakes, and they will disagree with one another. But, with luck, if you can have a society that is open enough so that people can freely disagree with one another and shout at one another if necessary, that ability to express what you feel will not eat away at the inside of you until your only recourse is to damage someone else or something else in order to let it loose. It doesn't make you necessarily comfortable when someone is angrily debating something or expressing an emotional reaction to what you say or what you do. I know it doesn't make me feel comfortable. I tend to want things to be quiet. I prefer reasoned discourse, and I like, how shall I say this, courtesy, because I was brought up that way. But not everybody feels that way about it. As I say, my youngest stepdaughter doesn't. She enjoys controversy. She enjoys argument. She thinks that it's fun. I have a caller on the line, ladies and gentlemen, who tells me that he is going to be nice and polite and respectful, so we'll see. Hello.
Good afternoon. This is Brown Beasley. I'm enjoying listening to you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Beasley. It's a pleasure to have you call in. Did you have a comment or a concern or question, sir?
Well, you're giving a lot of information out here. When you called me Mr. Beasley, I didn't have any problem with that. I actually think it's kind of cute. When I said titles, I wasn't referring to the Mr. I was referring to, I think you said that you think I'm a libertarian like you. I don't know what slot I fall into. I don't have a slot. I think independently. I think independently. I find that people have a tendency to categorize people. Even Ron yesterday, I just noticed that, you know, that they have to fit people into slots. Maybe that's how some people's minds work. It makes them able to navigate the world or people better. But I've found that, some people are that simple where you could fit them into a conservative, progressive, Republican, Democrat, you know, a slot. Some people are more complex than that and don't necessarily fit into those slots.
I can agree with that, and I do. Mm-hmm. I call myself a libertarian because for most people, thinking about all the different ways in which we are different is confusing and frightening. Human beings tend to be somewhat xenophobic. It's in our nature because it's genetically built in that the strange may be a danger.
That's so unfortunate. That's so unfortunate. I grew up in major cities, and I've been exposed to a multitude of different peoples. There's different. I don't know what part of the country you're in, but I've also there's also different peoples have different types of people or you know ethnicities of people have married into my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found that people are people.
Yes, they are.
And that you can, you know, you can, by prejudging someone or trying to fit someone in a slot, if you listen to what Ron said yesterday, that he couldn't believe a Jew, someone that was Jewish, that was raised Jewish, to be conservative. He had never seen that. And I'm thinking, what little box have you been in? You know, where you wouldn't have seen that. And I know that we all have a different experience. And I asked him where he's from, and he said he lived in Illinois, and I think he lives in Georgia now. And, you know, there are people that are isolated from other peoples. I'm just not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
What part of the country do you live? And your name is Terry?
My name is Terry. I live in Virginia. I was born in Illinois. I've lived in Michigan, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, visited Canada. I have a master's degree in transpersonal psychology and a bachelor's degree in Spanish. I've worked in public education for a little over 10 years, both as a substitute and as a full-time. Middle school, I am an in-school suspension teacher at a middle school.
What's an in-school suspension teacher?
That's
not like history or English or algebra.
In school suspension is a consequence for inappropriate behavior in school.
Oh my goodness! You're the jailer. Oh wow! Oh wow! Why did they pick you for that one? Wouldn't it have been nicer to teach anything else?
I am not at all interested in teaching classroom. The maximum number of students I have at any given time is between 7 and 10, depending on whether or not I have enough desks in my room.
I substitute
in regular classes. I can and do cover all of the middle school subjects, including foreign languages. The only one that I kind of avoid is gym, because I'm a little too old for bouncing up and down on trampolines. But my background is basically in one-on-one and small group tutoring, and I'm quite good at it. And in my in-school suspension room, the students who are sent to me for anywhere from 1 to 3 days must do the classwork that their teachers send, but they can request help from me if they don't understand it. I won't do it for them, but I will help explain it. And if they finish all their classwork and there's still time left in the day, they're given additional assignments in any or all of their 4 core subjects that I choose. And that is also required work, and that goes to their teachers as well as their classwork. So I'm both a jail and a quasi-tutor at the same time, Mr. Beza.
Wow. That's a task.
Especially You're right with, about that.
Especially like with, I'm assuming, 12 to 15-year-olds when, you know, their kids are really, they have a tendency to be pretty unruly.
Well, they also very rarely think above the waist at that age, too. So
the
you're
what?
Dealing with... They very rarely think above the waist. You're dealing with bouncing hormones pretty much every day.
Oh, well, that, I didn't even think about that.
Most people avoid it with a 10-foot pole, Mr. Beasley. When I substitute taught during the off-seasons at my other job, I was always in demand because the only school I wanted to substitute in was the middle school, and every other substitute teacher on the rolls avoided it religiously. They refused to take the job if it was at the middle school. But I've dealt with that age group for a very long time. I understand that they're neither fish nor fowl nor good red herring. And I also understand that in spite of their belligerence and their assumption that nobody over the age of 30 knows anything and only their peers are worth listening to, that underneath all of the bravado and all of the attempt to differentiate themselves from being mommy's little girl, there's a desire for predictability of some kind. I've said often on this show, and it's both sad and true, that many of my students tell me, you know, Ms. Roland, I really don't like it in ISS, but boy, I sure got a lot of work done and I learned stuff in here. And that's sad.
A lot of kids, maybe the discipline they're not getting at home or the boundaries, they can thrive in it.
They need
some boundaries. Now, of course, there's going to be some disturbed ones that no one can fix, not even a jail cell.
You're quite correct there, and I've had several of them. I call them my repeat offenders. But
repeat offenders.
They need, the kids of this age, and all the way through all the grades, need to have structure. They are not adults. So much of the progressive thinking in education is making the assumption that the child-centered classroom means the kid runs his or her own learning. Children are not adults. They cannot do groupthink. You can't put 4 12-year-olds on a committee and get anything done. They do not have the life experience or the mental acuity or the logic circuits yet developed to be able to approach
things that way. I think you could double their age
and
you couldn't get anything done.
Tell me about it.
Let's say you double that age again from 12 to 24. Let's double it to 48.
And you still probably won't get there. Yes, sir.
And that's Congress.
You got it. That is exactly
that's Congress.
So.
Back to your original point.
Yes, sir.
I just can't see having an armed guard. The idea of a teacher being armed.
I don't like it either, Mr. Beasley. Truly, I don't. Because I know that there are always unintended consequences whenever you have the ability to take a life from someone else. No matter what weapon you're using, whether it's a butcher knife, a rock, or whatever, there are always unintended consequences because under stress, people don't think, they feel. And when you feel, you do not make logical choices or reasoned choices. Fear,
emotion.
Fear is the mind killer, to quote a character in Dune. And it is. When you are afraid, your adrenaline takes over and not your reasoning ability. This is
isn't
the downside.
Isn't it noradrenaline?
The adrenaline rush that comes with stress is both the kind that makes you able to lift a car off your four-year-old child
mm-hmm.
and break through a door and stop a gunman.
What does noradrenaline do? I know fear is bad.
Mm-hmm.
What does noradrenaline do?
Noradrenaline, I believe, is the neurotransmitter that is involved in
It has the opposite chemical effect on the brain and in turn the body as adrenaline. So fear, adrenaline comes. It's still, they're chemicals.
Has a great deal to do with behavior.
What happened in Newtown is horrific.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how often it happens.
It doesn't happen often, and unfortunately...
Nothing that extreme.
No. Well, the worst massacre, Newtown actually wasn't the worst. The worst occurred, I believe, in Michigan in the 1930s. And I can't recall the exact date, but I did read an article about it from a newspaper of the time online. So this is not a new situation. It's not something that happens in every school. It is an anomaly. But you and I both know that the media is not interested in anything except viewership. They have to have that. Sell advertising.
And pushing an agenda.
Of course, pushing a political agenda at the moment, but the media has always done that. It did that in Washington and Jefferson's time as well. It's just that the results of their agenda we happen to like. The current agenda, the results I don't.
I think the media then was someone printing up a newsletter, a newspaper, and then passing it around. Now the media is, on a color widescreen television, on the internet, on the radio. The media is much more pervasive in our life.
And it doesn't require literacy, which is a good thing because we are raising functional illiterates. I've got another caller on the line. Can you hang on a minute?
Wonderful to speak with you, and I told you I'm a man of my word.
You certainly are, sir. I've enjoyed our conversation very much. Hang on.
God bless you. No, I'm done. Have a great day.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Beasley. I appreciate your calling in. Bye-bye.
Sure.
Hello?
Well, good afternoon, my dear. My name is Martha.
Martha, dear heart, how are you?
Hi.
Oh, so good to hear you, honey.
I finally got on, and I also put a change on my phone service, too.
so
things have changed.
I'm so glad that you joined us tonight. That's great.
And you are my... You're my first.
Oh, wow. I am so honored.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just can't tell you how honored I feel that you chose my show to call into.
I just actually managed to get in on time. I have a full house here. You know, I was listening to you talk about the kids, and I probably came in on this late, but was anything said about the influence of rap that's been going on for about 20 years and pervading this culture?
No, we didn't mention that this evening, but I do think it's a viable, cause for some of the attitudes that I see among young
people. It's horrible. I think it's what they say, and these kids... The parents listen to it, so the kids listen to it. And then they grow up believing it.
The same kind of reaction, Martha, happened in the 1950s with Elvis Presley and the rest of the rock and roll people, and that was innocuous. That's considered to be classic music now.
Right.
The problem that I have with rap, and the reason that I see that its effect is less deleterious than the rock and roll effect, what parents worried about with rock and roll was that it encouraged their kids to want to be different and to not dress the way mommy and daddy did. Well, you might as well just hang it up and not be a parent if you think you can get your kids not to want to be different and not to want to dress differently than mommy and daddy. They always do anyway. That's part of what goes on with rap. It's the lure of...
Well, I think the difference, though, between rap and rock and roll is the filthy language, the threats, the kill Whitey, all the stuff. We didn't have that in rock and roll. Not
no,
with Elvis, anyway. And that, you know, nothing just so vile and ignorant. And the kids are hearing it, and they live it. You hear it in the cars going by with their thumping, or whatever you call it. I don't know. But
I know. Drive-by shooting. Well, the problem that I see with rap, Martha, as far as being a cultural effect, is that it is a lot more divisive than rock and roll
yes.
was. Rock
yes,
and roll was not divisive. It had no agenda of hate somebody because they're not us. Rap does.
Exactly.
It's
exactly.
That aspect of it. The dirty language and the sexual... Kids between the ages of 12 and 20 are in love with filthy language. I worked for a while in a donut shop that was across the street from middle school. And in the mornings, the middle school kids would come over to the donut shop. They'd walk to school or their parents would drop them off early. And they'd come over there and hang around in the shop and get a donut or whatever. And I swear that, you know, a Barcelona whore would blush at some of the things those 12-year-old girls would say to each other and to the boys. It's nothing
unreal.
New. It is
unreal.
Nothing new. This is part of adolescence. They love the idea of pretending to be grown up. And this is an outward symbol of, look at me, I can use dirty words because I'm not a kid anymore. Generally,
and you can't do anything about it because you can't touch me.
And unfortunately, or fortunately, the vast majority of them eventually grow out of it. If it isn't promoted as a viable lifestyle for everyone. And that comes back to what Mr. Beasley was talking about the media and its agenda.
Well,
because
the media.
Because our kids are no longer reading books or even magazines or anything like that. They're sitting
I don't know if they know how to pick one up.
They don't know how to read one if they did pick it up. Trust me, I know.
I'm sure you do.
When you read something, you have to stop and think a minute about what it says. But 90% of the kids who are in love with this stuff are not really listening to all of the lyrics. They're hearing dirty words and feeling, oh, wow, look at me. I'm being so cool. I can say, and I can say,
and walking around with your pants to your knees.
Yeah, and they are energized and activized by the beat. And that is the nature of music. The driving kind of, verbal vomit with a beat that rap is, which is my description of it.
To me, it sounds like war drums.
And that's exactly what it is. Music,
yes,
sonics, affect emotions. The cathedrals of the Middle Ages, like Notre Dame in Paris, were built the way they were built, with the high vaulted ceilings. For the same reason, the Mormon Tabernacle has its tabernacle with a leather ceiling, because when the Mormon Tabernacle choir sings in there, it creates a sonic vibration that induces awe, reverence, and a peak experience.
Yes.
Sound affects emotion. And for
it sure
kids,
does.
Kids don't like sitting still, most of them. They want to be doing. They want to be. Their bodies are growing. They've got excess energy. They don't know what to do with. A lot of it is sexual energy. Moving around, dancing, rubbing up against each other, beat, and so on. This has been the case for adolescents going
forever.
Back to the. Yeah, ever since Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal argued over territory.
Well.
And it's the same kind of stuff that went on 30 years ago with the heavy metal bands. Oh, good Lord. My father thought the Beatles were disgraceful. Those long-haired, nasty boys. I mean, my God, compared to somebody like the characters on Duck Dynasty, who are the idols of the conservatives, with their beards down to their knees and their hair down to their
butt. Isn't that hysterical? I love them.
It is. My husband used to say, when he wore his beard long and his hair long, about, I guess, just before we got together. And then he shaved all his hair off when he got divorced from his ex-wife. But he wore his hair long, and he used to laugh and say, if I had looked like this driving through the South in the 1960s on my motorcycle, somebody would have shot me. Now I look cool. It's the changes that come up, and none of them are new. It's the need for young people to appear to be somebody other than mommy or daddy's little boy or little girl. And it is the nature of human beings.
But then you have somebody like Miley Cyrus doing her thing, and
again,
the kids want to imitate it.
Of course they
and
do.
Nobody. And, there's the and, of course the media just eats this up, and they're just pushing it. Thank you for the Communist Manifesto.
Because sex sells. That's and they have known that ever since advertising was born on Madison Avenue, Martha. It's not new. And I agree. I find it disgusting. I wouldn't attend a concert like that. Kids want to. Kids want to because other kids want to. At their age, between the ages of 12 and 18, and I've worked with kids in that age group for 40 years now, they all are constantly ranting and raving about what individuals they are, so long as they're exactly like all of the other individuals in their peer group. They have no clue what individuality is. To them, individuality is dressing like, looking like the popular kids at school. And something
and
that
different.
I tell them, yeah, that's being
from
different,
the parents.
Just like everybody else, right.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the growing up process. It's been going on since Plato and Socrates. And it will continue to go on because we are human, and it's part of our developmental process. It's not any different now than it was in a Native American tribe in the Southwest in prehistory. Everybody, when they're kids, want to do something to rebel against their parents' ideas. Purely
except
and simply
the parents,
because
the parents would bring them right back in line.
Yes, and that's the problem.
Which is not happening anymore. We're not allowed to.
That is the underlying problem. It's not the music. It's not the media. It's the family. It's the nuclear family, which has been pushed to the back burner and disrupted as much as possible by the progressives and Fabian socialists, because they know and they understand that it is the nuclear family where the basic values and ethics are taught. And no matter how you try, you cannot go to everybody's house and demand that they teach their kids what you think they should know. And it's a damn good thing you can't. But progressives want it to be so that there are not individual families and not individual houses, because that means people will think for themselves, and you can't do that and have a viable board.
Can't do that. Just have to be nice little good worker ants.
Exactly. And they will try and try and try, and they will fail. Because every time they've tried it, they've failed. You can't kill the human spirit, Martha. You can kill the individual human. And yes, I get just as annoyed at the filthy lyrics and rap music, and I cannot find anything attractive about Miley Cyrus's twerking performance. That was something that I would do in the privacy of my bedroom with my husband, not on a stage with a microphone. But that's me. And if she makes money that way, that's pretty much all she cares about, because she can't
remain
a little
girl forever. And the attention. And the attention doesn't matter whether it's negative or not.
Exactly.
As long as she gets the attention.
And that is endemic, and that is part of what our public school system has done to our kids. Like I've talked about before, like I was talking about with Mr. Beasley. Kids need an imposed structure. They do not have the life experience yet to make their own.
Do you have the, has Corbin taken up in Virginia?
No. Our standards of learning here were sufficiently rigorous, according to the Federal Department of Education, that we were not, carrot and stick with Common Core. The big problem with Common Core is that it's tied to the federal funding that goes for a lot of special education teachers, staff,
right.
Grants,
etc. I'm aware of that. I just I'd rather do without funding and just shut down Department of Education. All they're doing is sucking up money and dumbing down.
Uh-huh. Yep, they are. And the pathetic part of it.
I don't know why we can't get rid of it.
If you look at its original charter, when that idiot Jimmy Carter created it, No, dear, it was Jimmy Carter.
70?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Then what?
Jimmy Carter.
Okay, then I guess it was Nixon that brought in EPA.
Uh-huh, that's right.
Yeah, okay, I got him backwards.
The Department of Education's original mandate, they were barred from having any influence on curriculum anywhere in the country. That was part of their original charter and their original foundation of what the Department of Education was supposed to do. They were not supposed to have any say in the curriculum choices of the individual states and communities' school systems. But nobody pays any attention to reading anything anymore. They just listen to the news or pick up something on the internet, and they don't investigate because we have an entire generation of people who are the product of 30 years of progressive liberal education in public schools.
It's disgusting.
And once they figure out that what Margaret Thatcher said about the problem with socialism, that you soon run out of other people's money, as soon as that hits them, everything's going to turn upside down and the human spirit will triumph again. Unfortunately, we're going to have to go through a lot of pain and discomfort and so on before that happens.
I think it's going to be more than just pain and discomfort.
But
I think it's going to get real ugly.
In order to keep going, I have to be, my glass is half full. I have to be an optimist, partly because it's the only way you can stay sane and do what I do for a living, and also because it's my nature. If I were to convince myself that we're all going to the nether regions in a handbasket and there was no use trying, I'd just go into my bedroom, take my cats, and poison all of us. And I can't do that.
I think we're going to prevail eventually, but I really think it has to get very ugly first.
Unfortunately, growing pains hurt.
Yes.
And that is what we're going through now. We've come to a point in our technological and scientific development that we no longer can remain isolated from the rest of the world. We cannot shut ourselves off and build a wall around this particular country and make sure no other idea gets in. For one thing, it's physically impossible, and for another, it's suicide. Any group that isolates itself like that, the gene pool suffers and it dies. And yes, we're a large country with over 300 million people, and no, it wouldn't happen overnight. But we have to live in the world we live in. We have to try to be an example. But being an example doesn't always work because there's always somebody else who doesn't want to be good. They just want to be rich. Rich in something. Rich in goods. Rich in power. Rich in fame. Rich in control. And that is part of human nature. It will not be any different. We've gotten better. And I do believe that we are getting better. But getting perfect? No. That I don't believe. So
I think we still have not hit bottom yet.
I tend to agree, and I certainly hope that we don't. Well, it's about time. We only have a little bit left of the show. It's
time to finish up.
And I'm so glad you called tonight, Martha. And
well, I'll do it again now that I can finally
get on. Don't be a stranger. I love to hear your voice, honey. And I want everybody out there in the chat room and who's listening out in the Ethernet, I want to thank you for being here tonight, ladies and gentlemen. It is a joy to speak with you, whether it's on the phone or in the chat room or just talk to you out there over the air. Thank you all for being here. And please visit our website, www.patriotfamilies.com. And I'll see you next Thursday at 6 p.m. for Patriot Education. And as always, all my love to my greatest fan.
Good night, Terry.
Night.
Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education. And on Friday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Exposed but Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.